You're listening to the Money Talks podcast. I'm Kevin Farrell, joined by Dr. Nancy Lotridge-Anderson, president of New Perspectives, and Ryder Taft, portfolio manager at New Perspectives. On this show, our guests are George and Jason Hester of Navitas Wealth Advisors in Ridgeland. They're joining us to talk about family-owned businesses. So we usually start off the program talking about financial news in the news, but I'm going to throw a bit of a curve to Nancy and Ryder this morning. And that is, tax day has just passed us by. Do we need to start thinking about something? Would it be a good idea to maybe do something to get a super early start on next year's taxes? Ryder, what do you think?
So the first thing that you do after tax day is you just let your CPA take a nap, and
Amen.
Then you let them take their vacation. They've got to get their 2 to 3 week vacation, and so you also need to forget about taxes for 2 weeks. But then immediately after that, yeah. So a lot of people may have filed an extension, and possibly just because they didn't gather some documents in time, possibly because they missed something, got something in late. Just make sure if you weren't totally organized for the first deadline, go ahead and start getting organized for the next one. But also, yes, there is tax planning to do. So if you are withdrawing from investment accounts, if you're withdrawing from retirement accounts, which have tax implications, and you have not already kind of looked and seen what you can afford to do, what is going to bring you up to the next tax bracket, kind of what level of withdrawals, planning on where all that money's coming from that you're going to live off of this year. That's a great time to do that because you probably have a real good idea of what you had last year, a pretty good idea of how those things will change. That's your first step, is seeing what you have and how it's going to be different from last year to kind of develop a plan for income this year.
And look at your withholdings. That's always a big issue for a lot of people. On your W-2s, maybe you withheld too much, and so you've got a big fat refund. Well, some people really like that, Kevin. But you may need to pare back because you're just paying the government to hold your money. You're not collecting interest on those extra withholdings. But if you're not withholding enough and it gets really painful for you to write that check to the IRS, go back and revisit that. We have a lot of folks who are getting Social Security. They will withhold some tax, but you have to fill out a special form to do that. And we have several CPAs on our calendar right now. As Ryder said, we're giving them some room to take a breather, but we're going to be looking towards next year and what kind of things can we do, whether it's Roth conversions or capital gains, all of those issues. This is the time to start thinking ahead.
Guilty as charged, by the way. I do like getting that little windfall tax time, and it certainly is an incentive. If you get money back, it's an incentive to go ahead and file early, which I always manage to do. So sometimes by the time tax time rolls around, I forgot about it. Oh, yeah, but I got mine a long time ago.
Thank you for your service, Kevin.
So, Nancy, what's on your mind this morning, financially speaking?
I'm thinking about reversion to the mean, and reversion to the mean in statistics is the average. And in investing, we often talk about things will go back to average because the stock market doesn't function in a straight line. It comes in fits and starts. And just recently, I was reading about Kathy Woods and her ETF, ARK, that had gotten so much news and buzz during the pandemic. She was the darling. She was on all over the business magazines and websites, and everybody was jumping in. And this is what investors tend to do. They jump into whatever they think did well last year. And if that reverts to the mean, you're going to lose money. Think about cryptocurrency. Tesla stock is down 45%. That's a big holding in ARK, and it's the reason that a lot of people are now withdrawing their money out of ARK and losing a lot. So think about that as you go forward and look at your 401k. Often people will just pick that mutual fund that did the best last year, and things change. And if that fund reverts to the mean, you're going to go down. So it's better to look for a longer-term average and pick the one that maybe hasn't done as well in the near term, but performs better in a longer term. And when it reverts to the mean, you make money.
Ryder, what have you been thinking about this week?
I have also been thinking about stock and bond performance just because we are off 4% from our highs, a big scary 4% down from all-time highs in the S&P 500. And whenever we're down a few percent, especially after such a great run like we had last year and first quarter this year, people are always worried, what is happening? Why is this happening? What's next? And I think a lot of this story is with interest rates. Kind of talked before, medium term, yes, it's super short-term events, news can drive stock changes very quickly. Medium-term interest rates play a really big role. And the story at the beginning of the year is the Fed's going to cut, interest rates are going to be lower. The stock market likes that. Also, kind of benign economic news, so there wasn't a real worry about that. But interest rates being the price of money going down, then things which are money, the stocks going up, getting more valuable. So that's why we had a great first quarter. Economic news and on the inflation and employment front kind of looks still pretty warm, pretty hot. So maybe the Fed's not going to cut rates quite as fast as we're thinking. Fannie Mae put out a projection saying we're going to have mortgages above 6% for another 2 years at least in their eyes. And they are back up to 7%, I believe, is where they're at. And so those rates are, you know, still up. Longer-term rates are up a little bit higher, and so the stock market has pulled back just a little bit. 4%, it's nothing to go crazy over, nothing to worry too much over. This is a very normal sort of move, but just after all those all-time highs, we're feeling really good, and it's just a bummer to see a down month, I know.
This is Money Talks on MPB Think Radio. If you have a personal finance question that you need help with this morning, you can give us a call. The number is 1-877-MPB-RING. It's 1-877-672-7464. So, Ryder, as our resident cryptocurrency expert, I saw that Bitcoin was in the news this week about they're halving the amount of Bitcoin that's out there.
The halving. Okay, so this is and thank you for that title. I don't know how well I deserve it. Fellas, do you know anything about Bitcoin? Are y'all big Bitcoin halving followers?
No.
Did you go to any Bitcoin halving parties? I did see a lot of people were hosting parties for this. So essentially, Bitcoin is, you know, computers are solving complex problems which generate a token which is traded for money. So to encourage the computers to solve these problems, they are rewarded with some Bitcoin, which is theoretically, you know, worth something. You can go trade that on Bitcoin exchanges today. And the certain amount of time, certain amount of Bitcoin that is generated, the amount they are rewarded for solving that problem and generating those Bitcoin is cut in half. So a lot of the thought here is that reward decreases, there's less Bitcoin that's just kind of sold immediately because these people who are quote unquote mining the Bitcoin or solving those problems, they have to pay their bills. This takes a lot of electricity. This takes a lot of very expensive computers. If you've heard us talking about NVIDIA over the past few months, it takes some very expensive computer processing power. It takes a lot of electricity to do this. So they typically sell that. So whenever there's less that is being sold automatically, people think, oh, that's going to increase the value. Again, less selling and less pressure to sell and more desire to buy. You would expect that price to go up. I don't know how much really the long-term impact of the halving event. Again, the reward was cut in half. That's why they call it the halving. I feel that's not really a real word, though.
Ryder, that sounds like a reverse split.
I don't know, but it's kind of like maybe, but it's kind of a commission, but I'm not sure who's getting it. I don't know. There is a little less selling pressure, possibly. However, the miners still have all of these costs. They've got to get the money from somewhere. So, and Bitcoin is the thing they have and they trade in anyway. So I don't know that it really means that they are, there's less selling pressure. One thing is it's harder to generate and it's harder to transfer Bitcoin. And I may be misspeaking a little bit there, but the costs of that are increasing. So presumably some of just the hard dollar value in some sense of Bitcoin is increasing. But that's it. That's getting a little out of my realm there.
The Havening, though, that sounds like a great horror movie title. So if the Bitcoin thing doesn't work out, then, maybe Hollywood can pick up on that.
Bitcoin can go into horror movies. Yeah, that's a great.
This is Money Talks on MPB Think Radio. Our website, moneytalks.mpbonline.org, is one way to hear past broadcasts. You can also download the MPB Public Media app for your smartphone. Then you can listen to all of the local MPB Think Radio programs on your schedule. Kevin Farrell here with Dr. Nancy Lotridge-Anderson, President of New Perspectives, and Ryder Taft, Portfolio Manager at New Perspectives. Nancy and Ryder are here ready to answer your personal finance questions. Today, though, we also have a couple of guests in the studio. Throughout the hour, we'll be visiting with George and Jason Hester of Navitas Wealth Advisors in Ridgeland. So we're going to be talking about owning a family-owned business, and the Hesters have been in a podcast that you can download if you want to hear more, if this whets your appetite on the family-owned businesses in Mississippi. It's the Family-Owned Podcast, so you find that at your normal podcasting place. But just a little plug there, we'll be talking with the Hesters, but much more in-depth on there on that family-owned podcast. So, George, if you would, tell us about the origins of the company.
Well, Kevin, I started out in the financial services business in 1972 in Kosciuszko, Mississippi. And once I got started into the business, I was drawn to family-owned businesses. I wanted to learn to solve problems that people had as opposed to being a product peddler or whatever. And so several years into it, I started really going to tax institutes and schools and whatever, and I got really excited about helping family businesses because I saw a statistic that said that 65% of the family businesses lose their wealth families lose 65% of their wealth by the end of the second generation, and 90% of their wealth is lost by the third generation. I said, well, something's not working just right. Then look at business statistics. Only 10% of family businesses really survive to the third generation. So hence, we saw an opportunity. We started really striving at that time to really find out what the problems were and how do we create processes and procedures to help these families successfully transfer their generational wealth from one generation to the next. So that's what we do today. And so we built a national practice from North Carolina to California, got on the speaking circuit in late 80s, early 90s, particularly in the construction industry and financial services industry, showing families, you build a business, now what? How do you successfully transfer it to the next generation? How can you be part of that 10% that survives the third generation as opposed to the mortality rate of 90%?
Jason, was this something that you always wanted to be part of? How did you get involved in the business?
Yeah, I think from the beginning, always assumed I would go to work in the family business. So started out of college there, took about a 10-year break and did consulting work and some nonprofit work. And then came back in 2015 and been there ever since.
And George, sort of the other way around on that question, was that a family-owned business something that you wanted to really do to build?
Well, certainly, when you get started out in a business, your first thought is survival when you start from scratch. And so that was not in my forefront of my brain at that time. But as the business began to grow, I wanted to give I have four children, and Jason had expressed some interest. But I wanted to open that door if he wanted to come into it and give him the freedom to do otherwise. But then certainly as the business grew, and after about 25 or 30 years, succession became a big issue at that point. And so not only do I have a son who's now, Jason's the CEO, so I work for him now.
Which is fun.
So I've had to go through this transition. I've been talking to families for 50 years now. And you have to practice what you preach. But I also have a son-in-law in the business. And he's been in the business as long as Jason had. Now, that's really dicey. And so when we started that process 20-plus years ago, and I tell folks I have a PhD in mistakes because I've made every mistake that you can possibly make. But it's been very rewarding now because now I see, You know, he's going to take they'll take the framework what we've developed over the years. Now they'll take it to the next level, and it there comes a critical point that the patriarch has to transfer. And because what I don't want to do is be in my 80s and drooling on myself and still trying to run the company. But
Me either.
And so I'm at par with them as far as stock ownership, and we have two other partners, and we have offices here in Atlanta and Raleigh. But so it's been really great to see how they've taken control, taken leadership role, and they still let me come in. I'm working as many hours as I was when I was 50 years old, but I'm enjoying it. I'm doing it because I want to. But it's been really rewarding to do that and help families to do that, come up with a strategy, and how do you do it? You know, what's the proper way to do it? Because sometimes you have some kids involved in the business and other children who are not involved in the business. And then so the question becomes, how do you create parity for the whole family? And so that's the fun part of what we do.
One thing that, George, that you just said that I thought was interesting was that you let Jason decide whether he wanted to be in the business. You said that you expressed an interest, we would like this to be in the family, but you kind of gave him the freedom to say either yes or no. Is that important when trying to build a good business?
You know, I think it's critically important because it goes back to the relationship issue with the father and son and father and daughter. I never wanted my children to come into business because that's how they felt they're going to get affirmation, receive affirmation from me being in part. And so many families that we've seen, the children are involved in the business, not because they wanted to, not because that was their passion, because this is what daddy wanted. Or that they felt like this is what expected of them. And that's the worst thing you can possibly do. It's not good for the business. It's not good for them, for their own self-esteem, the self-worth. And so I think it's critically important to give your children an opportunity to blaze their own path and not live under the shadow of the patriarch or whatever.
I'm hearing that giving your child a job in the family business is not a substitute for all the other years of raising them that you still need to have done and passing on the other values that you might have, even if they don't work in the family business.
That's right.
So, Jason, was that something that kind of helped influence you, the ability to say, yes, I want to, but if not, I can go elsewhere?
I think it goes back to what you were saying, Ryder. It was more about the, coming into a family business, we learned in a business setting, we're not father and son, we're George and Jason. So, so when George brought me into the business, but more than anything, when he raised me, it was more he created in me the desire to be independent. Taught me those values, gave me an identity. So it was, I made an independent choice that I wanted to come to work with him. And that was based on the relationship that he and I had more than anything, was that I couldn't imagine having a better partner or somebody to go to work with. So for me, coming straight out of college, I never thought about doing anything else. I think looking back, and we've had conversations about this, and one of the things that we coach families on now is I should have worked somewhere else for a couple of years because, you know, breaking out of those familial roles before you go to work with each other is really important because he could see me as somebody who worked for him, but he also still saw the 12-year-old that burned 40 acres down with a bottle rocket.
Oh.
That's another story for another day.
Why didn't we? Well, that wasn't in that first question, was it?
Is there a third generation interested in the business?
I don't think so at this point, but the door remains open. One thing that we've done over the last few years is we've broadened. So we have six partners now, six shareholders, and we all have families. And so we have those conversations from time to time. But I think it's working in the same way. If kids express interest, we're creating a process, same thing we teach families to do, so that we would put them through the same process that we coach our families on.
So that touches back on, you know, the survivability of a family business through the third or family wealth at all through the third generation. How does what y'all have done and what you've helped and what do you coach others in doing and you bring on other partners? Of course, with the bigger, broader business world, you might see a company taking outside investors and going public. And that's what makes, you know, that's why for instance, Exxon is still around, even though the Rockefeller, you know, John D. Rockefeller is not. What are methods of helping the business survive? Because surely you founded the business because you saw a need for it, and at some point you do want to see that survive as well, in addition to your family do well. What are other methods besides just like crossing your fingers that your kids come back into it of helping the business itself survive and grow into a changing world?
You want to take that?
Yeah, for us, it starts with the strategic plan of the business. You got to have a 10-year vision of where you want the business to go and a 3 to 5 year plan of how you're driving growth. And that needs to inform the positions that you create more than just the fact that you want family members to be in the business. Mm-hmm. So creating a fair economy where family members come into the business just like anybody else would, and they have to move their way up. That's first and foremost for us, is make sure the business is leading in terms of creating roles, creating opportunities. Mm-hmm. Keep the business healthy. Then you start, because you can inevitably, you come to the place where the family needs start to decide, drive business decisions. And anytime that happens, it's not a good outcome.
What's an example of family needs driving a business decision?
So if you take the stock of a business, for example, and you start to push it down through the company, through the generations mm-hmm. of a family, mm-hmm. well, all of a sudden distributions start to matter more than retention of profits for investment back into the company. Or you look at, hey, I want to provide an inheritance to my heirs, so we're working with a family now that we're trying to help unwind their current plan. 48 shareholders, 6 of them are active in the business.
So you have a lot. You have 42 people who don't necessarily have the same alignment of interest or the same understanding of the business.
Right.
That those 6 who really
but
want,
but they want income.
See that?
Yeah.
That can get contentious, I imagine.
Yeah.
You know, and another problem we see oftentimes too is, you know, as Jason says, when you bring someone into the business, they come into the business, a clear job description. But a lot of times families, because they may have different children involved in the business, they're paying them all the same. Mm. The job description doesn't have anything to do with what their compensation is, because they want to be equal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so Jason does a really good job of addressing that with the clients. And as you onboard, you know, what opens the door for a family member to come into the family business? What are those, you know, prerequisites? How does it look?
So, Jason, you're helping parents choose their favorite child. Is that?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So they have a process. So if anyone has questions about how to choose a favorite child, they've got a process.
We got a process
here.
For
yeah,
that.
Okay. That's fantastic.
Money Talks is MPB Think Radio's personal finance broadcast. Kevin Farrell here with Dr. Nancy Lottridge Anderson, president of New Perspectives, and Ryder Taft, portfolio manager at New Perspectives. They're both chartered financial analysts, and Ryder holds the Certificate in Investment Performance Measurement from the CFA Institute. Today, we're also visiting with two guests. We're talking with George and Jason Hester of Navitas Wealth Advisors in Ridgeland, talking about the unique dynamics of a family-owned business. So, George, Jason, I'd like to get some perspective on this one from both of you. But how do the family dynamics impact decision-making and operations within the family-owned business?
Well, I'll start, and Jason, you can chime in, but I think that's probably the majority of where the issues are within family dynamics. I mean, the family dynamics, the non-financial issues, because when you look at those statistics, that 65% of the failure rate, there's a 65% failure rate at the end of that, you know, second generation. And 60% of the failure rate is due to lack of communication, which leads to a lack of trust. Because sometimes the patriarch, you know, we as dads sometimes, we say, you know, I'm a good communicator. I'm going to talk and you listen. Well, that doesn't work well for a 45-year-old son or daughter or, you know, any adult, even teenagers at times. But the fact is that the lack of communication, and then having done this for 50 years with some of the most affluent families in America, that's a common problem. Is not having a process for effective communication within the family itself to communicate what the plans are pre-death, before it happens, and so no one is caught off guard, you know, after death, post-death. Mm-hmm. And so we started having family meetings in the early 90s, In fact, I started bringing in psychologists as part of our team members in the early 90s because I recognized it was the non-financial. It's the lack of communication which leads to a lack of trust. The other big one was 30% of the failure rate was because the next generation was not prepared to receive the wealth. Most estate plans are about preparing the wealth for the children, not preparing the children for the wealth. And 60% of affluent families, the biggest concern they have, one of the biggest concerns, is that how is this wealth going to impact that next generation? Is it going to screw them up? Excuse the term. But is it going to screw them up, or is it going to take? Are they going to take that wealth and take it to the next level? And so that's where we spend much of our time mm-hmm. with these families. It's not about how much more can I get in my investment portfolio, da-da-da-da, on the financial. It's oftentimes it's, they really want to focus on how do we protect our children, you know, how do we prepare our children, and then and how do we have a process for really having healthy debates or and conflict management, because we're all dysfunctional. And you get the family in the mix, that just amplifies it. You put money on top of that, that even amplifies it even more. So the family dynamics are critically important and play a big role in the lack of communication.
Yeah, I'll tell you a quick story. It was a family we were working with, so $100 million revenue company at their peak, and they had dropped to $60 million revenue. The company was completely divided into two camps. It was a dad, right back to something that you were saying. He was making up for lost time by mm-hmm. creating two positions for them. Mm-hmm. So he had one over ops and one over sales and marketing. The company was completely divided into two camps. And after, I don't know, maybe 90 days of interviews and talking through and walking through, when we got to the bottom of it, it was a brother and a sister. When she was 7 and he was 5, he beat her up, and the dad laughed about it.
Ooh. Oh, my goodness.
Not great then and not great now.
This is two 50-year-old adults that had split an entire company because that wound was never healed. And that family dynamic mm-hmm. tore the company apart.
And if you're wondering about the family dynamic here in the studio, I am sitting in between George and Jason. So I will do my best, folks. I'll do my best.
Good luck. He doesn't fight fair.
All right.
So I have a question about employees who are not members of the family, because I would think that's a special category where you have to deal with them and make sure that they are rewarded so that they feel like, you know, there's no bias towards those family members.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is you have a fair process, but then, you know, 20-something years of doing this, there's no way to not have a bias for a family member. So you might as well put it on the table and be honest about it. To the extent that you can, you create equitable arrangements when you can. But it's still a family member that's ultimately going to inherit the business unless you set a process up that points it in a different direction. So I think when you're hiring people or you're bringing people in or you start to bring family members on, you have to have an honest conversation about that. And you can't be putting broken people into the company to try to rescue them. But we have found over the years that as long as the family member is good and they're capable and they build good relationships and they work really hard, that a lot of times the non-family employees really care about the family. And it's a good thing. It can be a really good thing.
If it's a healthy culture. Yeah.
So one thing I think that I guess that one of the keys to success possibly would be that in a family-owned business, you have to learn to leave the business. When you leave the structure, the buildings, let's say, let's leave the family business, and then when you get to the other structure, the home, then we're a family again. And again, kind of your example, Jason, that rift had not been healed for all those years and caused the business to suffer. So how do you advise people to leave business as business and home as home?
Look, I mean, Jason may sound like our transition was smooth, but it wasn't. And it wasn't his fault.
Half of it.
I have a son-in-law as well. But one rule we always have had is that, okay, he and I can get into conflict, and we have gotten into conflict before. It was healthy conflict. But the fact is, I didn't go home to talk to my wife about it, his mother about it. And he didn't go home and talk to Brandy about it. And what we see mistakes made, so many times, particularly in family businesses, the sons or daughters who are actively involved, when they have a conflict at the office with a parent or another family member, they go home and talk about it. Well, you go back to work the next day, Jason and I, we've had some pretty strong conversations, but before the day was out, or by the next day, we reconciled. Well, but if you go home and you get your spouse involved in that conversation, then they may take offense to it. And they sit down on the outside, and they still are angry. And I can't tell you how many opportunities and clients that we run, that we have situations that the spouses, boy, they're really offended at what was said at the work or whatever. So that's a critically important piece that family members should. If you come to work for the business stays home when you go home. Mm-hmm.
And Jason, I think one of the dangers might be that if you share something from the business with another family member, they might not agree with what your point of view is, and that might cause some issues.
Yeah. No, it can. Definitely having rules of engagement for how you operate outside of the business. And we help families do that. We help them create rules of engagement. And they may be things as simple as soon as you start drinking, you stop talking about business. If you're going to open up an issue with a spouse, you find one or two things are going to happen. You start to create a divide between your spouse and that other family member. Or in my case, if I ever kick that door open, my wife starts jumping on board with the other side of the equation. And so it starts to create tension in our relationship.
Might be a lesson there. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. So if you do leak that out and you start a conversation with the spouse, you got to come back around and close the door. How did it resolve? Was it healthy? Knowing what family time is and what it's not. So for George and I, he's George in a work setting, and he's Pops when we get home. And we've been really able to respect that so that if he wants to talk about business, it's permission-based. But then we also understand we're in the middle of the family thing. So we keep those things really tight, and that's helped us.
Can I add one point?
Sure.
Another key that when I saw him blossom is when his bonus was not discretionary.
Amen.
Okay. Because oftentimes as parents, what we do is that, we have another client case in another part of the country, and the dad was almost, created the image of the atmosphere of, well, you come kiss my ring and you get the bonus. Well, and I realized in some ways I was doing the same thing. And so when you bring children into the business, they should be paid based upon what the job description is and what the market is for that. And also if there's bonuses associated with that, there's a formula for doing that. And so when I got out of when I removed myself from making discretionary, we had a formula. It gives them a lot more incentive, and I saw them take a lot more responsibility too. And it began to change. It's a growing process because I hadn't done this before.
And we talked about the idea of not letting an issue boil over from the business to the home, but the idea is kind of resolve that issue before you go. And not only is that good for the family, but that's also a good business practice, I would guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, otherwise that goes to culture if you don't deal with it. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
We're glad you found our show, Money Talks. Kevin Farrell here with Dr. Nancy Lottridge-Anderson, president of New Perspectives, and Ryder Taft, portfolio manager at New Perspectives. We're visiting today with George and Jason Hester of Navitas Wealth Advisors in Ridgeland, talking about the dynamics of a family-owned business. If you're interested in what we're talking about this morning and want to learn more about family-owned businesses, you can download the Family-Owned Podcast at your favorite podcasting app. George and Jason, I think you all have 3 episodes on there. So,
yes.
It'd be interesting to go a little bit more in-depth than the hour that we have here on the show. So I want to kind of follow up. Nancy kind of brought this up, but the non-family employees, what role do they play in the success of family-owned businesses, and how can they be integrated into the family dynamic?
Jason, that's yours.
Yeah. So the role of non-family members, again, I would come back to it's the mission of the company, the vision of the company, and the org chart, and finding their best people for the right positions. And when you're looking at a transition plan or succession plan for a founder of a company, you think about it, when you start a business, I'm the president, I'm the chairman, I'm the CEO, I'm everything. But as a business starts to grow, those roles start to separate. And so building really good non-family members, it keeps the dynamics balanced. They play a vital role in negotiating communications and running certain parts of the business that you don't have to deal with the dynamics of the family side that kick in. But to me, it's just, it always pushes back to when we come in, I don't look at it as family members and non-family members when we're building a plan or a business. It's roles and responsibilities and functions. It's compensation. But as long as you don't start dividing people and pulling them into camps, it's easy to keep it as one, just one dynamic within the company.
So what are some best practices for fostering communication and collaboration among family members involved in the business? How do you get them on board, I guess?
Well, I think one of the first things that we learned is that in the early 90s that most families were not communicating their plans to their families. Well, their estate plans, because the estate planning deals with the life of the owner of the business. The business succession plan deals with the life of the business itself. There's two separate things. But from a planning perspective, you got to integrate those plans together. And so one of the best practices that we found is that what we started doing years ago was having family meetings at the appropriate time. And as families would go through this planning process, particularly if you've got some kids involved in the business, other kids who are not involved in the business, to find out what their interests are, and then start exploring with them what they're like, what their interests are as far as vocational-wise. But then as the parents start to formulate their plans for their estate plans to be equitable with their family members, not necessarily equal, because that's different, and start educating them as to what's going to happen, what is estate planning, then what's going to happen upon our death, what's going to happen with the business, as opposed to waiting to something happening, and then they find out after the fact. And that creates a lot of confusion, because one of the things that we've learned is you, by preparing that next generation, you do share age-appropriate information, you know. And when you don't share information, well, so many parents are concerned about, well, if I share this information, they find out how much wealth we have. Is that really going to create? Is that going to create a negative effect on their ability to go out and, you know, blaze their own trail? But it has the opposite effect in many cases, because when you're not sharing information with a 40-year-old or 35-year-old or 50-year-old even, the parents not hadn't disclosed what the estate plan is or what the wealth transfer or the business succession plan is, then the message is that we don't trust you. And so it's really been creating having a platform for open dialogue and conversation, you know, where it's – and so the more that you can – help guide your family through there. And oftentimes, the fathers are not the best one typically to facilitate a family meeting. It's better oftentimes to have somebody outside to come in and help facilitate that, because that creates an opportunity for the family members to ask questions or whatever and feel more comfortable. And knowing what questions to, you know, lay the groundwork for that. Jason, you got anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think within the business side of it is, one, just making sure you have a good strategic planning process where you're having critical conversations at the right time. And then when the next gen comes in, they come into a business, a couple of things that you have to work through. One, they're not you. Like, George and I have completely different communication styles. We have completely different values. So if he expects me to communicate like he does, it's going to create conflict, right? Because I don't see the world like he does. So the business, if I'm taking the business over, and we've watched that, especially over the last 8 years, it has to transform into something that fits me. Because if I try to copy him, you know, copies are never as sharp as the original. And so with family members, it's figuring out what is your unique ability? Where is your secret sauce? And how do we build the business around that? And then for the next gen that's coming in, I know you want to grow the business and you want to change it. But before we do that, you need to understand what's sacred. What are those sacred stones that we don't need to move? Where are our opportunities to innovate? and how do we start to build the company around just a good strategic planning process where we have regular meetings and we're having critical conversations at the right time and in the right way.
So y'all touched on something that, I mean, I think applies to a lot of people passing on wealth, business or not, and that's the communication of the estate plan. And you mentioned doing it in an age-appropriate way, and it's not just like, hey, Jason, you're going to get $1 million when I die. nice. But what are those? Because you want to pass on more than just the dollar. We say that a lot. You want to pass on more than the dollars. It's more than just, oh, it's a trust, it's a will, it's a bank account, whatever. It's the values. What do you want to see with that? What's important to you? How did you earn that? How did you grow this business? Just like you were saying,
that's
Jason.
Right.
But how do you start those conversations? And what are kind of some age appropriate milestones, do you think?
Well, I'll take the first part and you take the second. I think, you know, one thing you don't do is you don't show a 21-year-old your financial statement.
Fair.
Okay.
Fair.
Okay. And sometimes that is applicable for a 40-year-old, but anyway, but typically, you know, what we do, and Jason's very unique too in some of the things that he does, but like we're meeting with a family in Dallas. And they're very interested in their daughters and helping their daughters find the right career path. And they're very intelligent. They're in college, senior in colleges or whatever. So one thing, we're going to have a family meeting. One thing we'll do is the personality profile. And as the whole family, mm-hmm. because about communication styles, you know, and how you process information, you know, and so forth. And Jason does a great job with doing that. But then also we'll start talking to him about basic planning. But what are your parents going through? This is called estate planning. What is estate planning? And just begin to precept on precept on precept. And then just basic definitions and explaining to them, this is what this means. So just start with those fundamentals. And then as they are, depending on the age or they're involved in the business or whatever, then you go a little bit deeper. It depends on the individual, that's you know, yeah. and their maturity level and so forth. Jason.
The first critical conversations start at 10 to 12, believe it or not. You know, all things feel equal until you hit 10 to 12, and then people start to divide out into classes. It's unfortunate, but it's what happens. And so we encourage families, that 10 to 12-year-old range, start having appropriate conversations with them about what they talk about, private planes, beach houses. Like, be careful, because you're going to start to set yourself apart. And then you can almost play it a decade ahead. So with 20-year-olds, you're talking about, hey, you're not going to start work for me. You need to go somewhere else. Your spouse is or isn't going to come into the business. You start to lay the groundwork, and you look at 30. You know, you just roll it a decade ahead, and you figure out where those family members are and what challenges they're facing, and then use your influence to help make that next decade of their life better.
All right. We are run out of time. So if you've been interested in our conversation about family-owned businesses this morning, remember you can get more in-depth by downloading the Family-Owned Podcast, and you can get that at mpbonline.org. That's going to wrap us up for today. Money Talks is a production of MPB Think Radio, funded in part by generous financial support from listeners. To hear today's show or previous show, you can visit moneytalks.mpbonline.org or listen to the podcast by searching for Money Talks. So for Dr. Nancy Lottridge-Anderson, Ryder Taft, and our guests George and Jason Hester, I'm Kevin Farrell, inviting you to join us every Tuesday at 9 for Money Talks. It's heard only on MPB Think Radio.